Welcome to the Risk and Repeat podcast, episode number 22. I'm Rob Wright, editor of searchsecurity.com, and I'm here with my site editor, Peter Loschen. Peter, welcome.
Hi, Rob.
It's good to be back in the studio. We had a week off, I guess. We're recording this on a Tuesday, the 11th of October. Normally, we do it at the end of the week, Thursday or Friday. I was out of the office, so we're here doing a same week recording, so this will be out in a couple of days. But Peter, we have some interesting things to discuss, because I was out Friday, and some news dropped late last week about the speculation regarding who was behind some of the sort of more politically, apparently politically motivated cyber attacks and hacks of the Democratic National Committee and various persons, and also I guess the attacks or attempted intrusions into some of the voter databases, voting systems in a number of states, which we've written about as well. Although I guess who's responsible for those particular attacks may be a matter of debate, and we'll get into sort of the details about what exactly is going on with the cyber attribution here. But yes, the U.S. intelligence community on Friday released an official statement implicating the Russian government in some of these notable hacks and cyber attacks. And specifically, the intelligence community said, and I'll read from the statement, they said they are confident that the Russian government directed the recent compromises of emails from U.S. persons and institutions, including from U.S. political organizations, the recent disclosures of alleged hacked emails on sites like DCLeaks.com and WikiLeaks, and by the Guccifer 2.0 online persona, are consistent with the methods and motivations of Russian-directed efforts. End quote. It's a pretty strong language. And in no uncertain terms, this is the first time that, at least in recent history, that the government has come out and said, yes, Russia is behind this. We know that these are Russian threat actors, and we believe the Russian government is directing it. Now, in the statement, they don't really outline specifics, although we'll sort of dive into the statement a little bit more in a minute. But Peter, what was your reaction when you saw this? Because I know what my reaction was when I saw it. Were you surprised?
I guess I was. The surprise is not so much that the government's confirming that the Russians seem to be behind it, so much as,
what's the next step? Exactly. I mean,
what do you do if you're saying somebody has violated your stuff? You know, usually the next step is to say, and this is what we're going to do about it. But right. They didn't really say that. Although they did say, didn't somebody say at a time and place of our own choosing, we'll respond?
Something to that effect, and I don't remember the specific official who might have said that. But other people have sort of discussed, well, does this mean sanctions, economic sanctions against Russia? Does this mean or something more severe? Does this mean an actual cyber attack back against the country? That's obviously, you can't really, I think this needs a little time to marinate and see what the response is from Russia. Russia obviously has said, you know, through its state-run media that, you know, the U.S. is wrong and full of it. But it's going to need to, I guess, marinate before and be dissected, which is kind of what we're doing here, Peter.
Right.
Before we jump to the point of well, this is how we're going to respond. This is because we are certain that this is what is going on. But you're right. It's this story, this angle has been teased and reported, and you know, unnamed government officials have said this, and now we learned not that long ago that in an intelligence briefing recently for Donald Trump, the Republican candidate for president, the U.S. intel community essentially laid out some of the details to him about what was going on and what they were doing to try to harden and protect. And I don't know what the DNC is doing But you're right. If these attacks are ongoing, and this means that other state voter registration databases or other state infrastructure related to voting might be affected, what are we going to do about it?
Well, I hesitate to even say this, but it seems like part of the purpose of the announcement wasn't so much to signal anything to Russia,
right,
as it is to let United States citizens know that there is something going on,
right,
and we do seem to I think a big part of the message here is being sent to the American people to say, look, something's going on, we're aware of it, we know who's doing it, and we'll take care of it. But you should also be confident in our systems and our establishments and our institutions that we're that are around voting, which are robust, more or less, even if individual systems in individual locations may not be so robust.
Right.
And I mean, we could spend hours talking about voting and never say a word about any government besides the United States, because there's a lot of issues that over the last 20 years that have come up around voting, and even before then, where people have concerns about electronic voting. It happened 16 years ago.
Hanging
chads,
impregnated chads.
Right, all of the chads, yes, and all of the, you know, the no audit trails on some of these devices, and the politics behind selling voting machines to local jurisdictions. But right now, I think the concern is that there are people that are going around shooting their mouth off and saying that everything's going to be rigged anyway.
I know.
And so this is, you know, and there's, you know, I can't remember since 2000 an election for the president where people haven't raised issues about people, you know, nefarious forces manipulating the voting system, and you know, none of them pointed outside of the country, but there were a lot of, there's been a lot of finger pointing over the years, so what are you going to do? I think that the key takeaway here is that the people, the grown-ups who are doing the work and know how this stuff all works, who are not referring to their 10-year-old son as being a wizard with a computer, you know, these are the people that have been doing investigations into computer crimes for dozens of years, and who know how it works.
Yeah.
These are the people that are saying to us that this is going on. Now, again, you know, we've gone through this. I think maybe towards the second half of last year, there was an issue about a release of a data dump of voter registration data.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And again, voter registration,
it's public data.
Public data, but you do wonder about what, if an intruder, and we've talked about this on a previous podcast, if an intruder was able to get into a voter registration database in, let's say, Ohio, and it was looking like a close election, you could go in and randomly alter data or delete data, start deleting names of registered voters randomly across several precincts, and in order to sway the vote one way or the other, depending on how you wanted to do it. And so then you have people showing up at the polls who think they're registered to vote, who can't vote, and maybe that's enough to sort of tip a state. And how would you know unless the voter registration records are backed up? And that's so you know, to your point about what is being done and the government saying, don't worry, we've got it under control. I mean, that is basically what they're outlining in this statement. The DHS and the Director of National Intelligence in the joint statement basically say, some states, I'm going to read from the statement, quote, some states have also recently seen scanning and probing of their election-related systems, in which in most cases originated from servers operated by a Russian company. Attribution, we're going to get to that in a moment.
Okay.
However, we are not now in a position to attribute this activity to the Russian government. Okay. The U.S. intelligence community and the Department of Homeland Security assessed that it would be extremely difficult for someone, including a nation state actor, to alter actual ballot counts or election results by cyber attack or intrusion. This assessment is based on the decentralized nature of our election system in this country and the number of protections state and local election officials have in place. States ensure that voting machines are not connected to the internet, and there are numerous checks and balances as well as extensive oversight at multiple levels built into our election process, end quote. Now, two things outside of the attribution stuff. Two things. Number one, this doesn't say anything about messing with voter registration data. It's merely the end result, the votes. And they're right. A lot of these voting machines, there are some that are made that are connected to the internet, but typically they are not. You would have to gain physical access to the voting machine to manipulate the data or find a way into the state election network to finesse the data after the fact. And if there's no paper trail, then you have no way to back up that stuff. So that concerns me, that there's no way to, that there's nothing in there about, okay, here's what we're doing for voter registration data, not the end result votes. And the other thing that is distressing to me is that this statement seems confident, but it comes on the heels of the news that, and we've have you know discussed this as well on this podcast, the states being asked for, or the states asking for help from DHS, or DHS offering help to these states to say, hey, do you need assistance with making sure that you haven't been breached, that you don't have an intruder on your network, that you don't have somebody stealing your data, that you don't have somebody manipulating that data? So that doesn't gel with, the quote, the number of protections that state and local election officials have in place. Do we, what protections?
Well, let me answer that.
Yes,
let
go,
me
Peter.
Answer that for you. And I have to say that I'm speaking as a privileged resident of Massachusetts, where I've been voting in my jurisdiction in two different precincts for the last 20 years.
Yes.
And I have to say that I'm very happy to say that we've never had long lines. We've mm-hmm. never had any problems with getting enough machines to vote
sure.
with or people to work the polls. And so I realized that, you know, based on reports that I've read, you know, 4, 8, 12, 16 years ago, some places they don't have a lot of machines. Some places they make it hard to vote. But for me, I'm privileged, I have to admit. And when I go to vote, I do look at the process and I see that there are people, there are my neighbors, the people that live in my town. So they may not know my name, but they certainly have very likely seen me around. So I know that when I go in there, they look, they have a big, well, I don't think they have the Fanfold green bar printouts from the mainframe anymore. But I do seem to recall that in the recent past.
Yeah.
But they do have a list. It's printed out. It's got everybody who's registered, their address. What is your address? They ask me, and
yep.
I tell them. And they say, are you Peter? And I say, yes, that's me. And they say, okay, well, here's your form. Fill it out, and you're good.
Mm-hmm.
And when I turn the form in, they check again, and they run it through. And I know that if I wasn't on the list, I could go to these people. There's police. There's always at least one or two police officers in the polling place.
Mm.
And, you know, again, I live down the street from one of the one of our town police officers, and I know some of those guys
sure.
just from walking around. I'll just go and I'll tell them, and I'm sure that there's a process where somebody will say, "Why isn't Mr. Lotion on the list here? He
right.
was registered last year, and I remember him coming in."
Sure.
And I know this guy. So that's not all of the checks and balances. That's just one thing
one
that I know
sort
in
of
my jurisdiction I can depend on.
Yeah, person-to-person type assurance.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we don't want to look at technology to answer a social problem.
Yeah.
This is a social problem, and we do have social solutions to it. So for me, that happens to be something that I don't, it doesn't keep me up at night thinking that I'm not going to be able to vote.
Right.
And being in Massachusetts, my vote is only going to be an amplification to the result, very likely, just because that's the way Massachusetts is.
Sure, sure.
Or a de-amplification if I happen to choose to vote one way or the other.
Sure,
but
sure.
The ultimate result is probably not going to be changed by my particular vote in this particular state. In other states, it's going to be different.
Yeah.
And I do stay up at night worrying about some of
those places. Because if it's a significant number, if it's more than just you, Peter, if it's dozens of people mm-hmm. in a high volume precinct who are saying, I voted last year, I'm registered to vote, why is my name not here, why can't I vote? That's not going to be manageable for a precinct. You can't, I mean, I think there are some dates that have same day voter registration, but I don't believe that most do. I'd have to go back and look. And that concerns me because you can have all the checks and balances in the world, but if someone who's obviously been registered to vote in a particular precinct has been there for 20 plus years like yourself, but all of a sudden isn't, you know, doesn't show up in the voter reg records on November 8th and walks in and says, what gives? There may be something that can be done on a personal level if the people behind on the other side of the table have a reasonable confidence in you being who you are, but not if it's 100, 200 people, if it's complete strangers,
I mean, I'm not saying that our system is perfect.
No.
I'm not even saying that it's necessary. I don't know that I could argue that it's even adequate, but it's what we've got.
Yeah.
And we have to depend on it. And,
right.
And depend on our system of government being robust enough to withstand some of these attacks.
Yeah.
As opposed to opening up doubt about it, which there are people who are doing.
Who are doing that, unfortunately.
That's really unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean, I hope this is like this sort of fear that I have of vote shaving or vote manipulation by going after the registration databases. This is all just sort of, you know, hey, I've been reading too many hacker novels or something. I don't know, or watching too much Mr. Robot. But, you know, going back to the official statement from DHS and the intelligence community, they did sort of cap off the statement by saying, okay, don't worry, these internet voting or these voting machines are not internet connected, and we have a number of protections in place at the state and local level. So, like you said, be calm. But they also say be vigilant, and they note in that last graph, DHS continues to urge state and local election officials to be vigilant and seek cybersecurity assistance from DHS, end quote. And they say in this, they said DHS is providing several services to state and local election officials to assist in their cybersecurity. These services include cyber, quote unquote, hygiene scans of internet facing systems. Wait a minute, you just said that the voting machines are not internet facing. So this must mean you're talking about the actual networks of the election systems within those state and local governments that have the voter reg data. Little concerning. And I'll continue. Risk and vulnerability assessments, information sharing about cyber incidents, and best practices for securing voter registration databases and addressing potential cyber threats. So clearly they know that something, just by nature of the intrusions, that something is, that they need to be careful, but and hopefully they're backing up all of this data and doing stuff to protect our, you know, protect the Republic, Peter. We should probably turn to the attribution question because that's important, and I think that it's something that matters not just to the government but to enterprises as well, because if this is how we're doing attribution, it lends some questions. So, like, going back to the statement, they said DHS and the intel community say in most cases the scanning and probing of election-related systems, state systems, originated from servers operated by a Russian company. Okay, that's interesting. I will say two things. Cyber attackers have used the platforms of American companies. They've used Dropbox. They've used Amazon. They've used Azure. And through no fault of those companies, I will say, because you can sign up for Dropbox with a free account. And we've seen attacks that use Dropbox as a command and control platform. We've seen people legitimately sign up for Amazon instances and have those instances co-opt by intruders. Same with Azure. I mean, Azure even, Microsoft takes the step of actually closing down an account if there is, seems like there's been a breach or suspicious activity. And I think Amazon might do the same. So that, you're starting to get into some gray areas.
True. But
because if you wanted to make it look like it was from Russia, all you would have to do is sign up with a Russian. I mean, they don't say what it is. I assume it's some type of infrastructure company or hosting company that they're using. And maybe the company is not reputable, which lends further credibility to this attribution. But if you wanted to make it look like it was coming from Russia, you just sign up for an account with some Russian hosting company that doesn't know any better, and you're off to the races.
Well,
and why would they use a Russian hosting company if they didn't, if they wanted plausible deniability? Sorry.
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, the points you raise are very valid, but at the same time, I think that the sophistication of our forensics people and the software and the tools that they have is the same as the attackers. Everybody's getting better at this. It's a, you know, when you talk about security, you're always talking about an arms race.
Mm-hmm.
You get a big lock and I get a bigger hammer. You get a bigger lock and I and a yet bigger lock and then I get an even bigger hammer. And that's just, you know, that's a very oversimplified way of putting it. But
right.
The fact is that there's, you know, the more attention that gets paid to this, and so in some senses this is a positive development for us because it makes us evaluate, you know, let's look at it. One of the benefits of having an anarchic and chaotic election system is that it is very, very heterogeneous.
Yes.
There's no single magic key that you can use to turn the election over to one party or
true.
The other.
It would take a lot of work.
Right, exactly. I mean, the magic key, there is no, if everybody's using a standard election machine and an election registration machine, and everybody's got the same stuff, then you don't need to break 50 of them or thousands of them for counties or towns or townships. You just need to break one.
Yeah.
Whereas the way it is now, it's utter chaos.
Right.
As far as, you know, going from one town to another, as far as going even from precinct to precinct, there's different machines, there's different systems, there's different processes.
Yep.
So that's all to the good. On the downside, as far as attribution, you know, which is really the question that you asked. I have to apologize.
No, but you're getting there. You're getting there.
I am getting there. So so the thing about attribution is, yes, a Chinese gang could use a Russian server. There's nothing stopping them from doing that. But if you want to do a false flag kind of thing, it's not as easy as it was 20 years ago or 50 years ago or 100 years. You know, remember the Maine? Spanish-American War,
yep.
William Randolph Hearst, and the, you know, the explosion, which was it the Spaniards that did it, or was it an accident, or was it on purpose?
Sure.
You know, but if you're doing a false flag operation at this scale, you've got to be pretty tight about how you make your false flag look like somebody else, as opposed to yourself. So you've got to have. There's language in the code that artifacts are left behind.
Yep.
There's ways people do things. I mean, the Russian cyber command probably has their own cyber school for cyber commandos.
Yeah.
And that they teach a certain way of doing things.
Style of coding and techniques. Yeah.
Right. So I mean, let's go back to the Shadow Brokers thing and Equation Group. I mean, the Equation Group was listed as an APT for a while.
Yes.
But now we all, you know, now it's also clear to us that the Equation Group is actually in operation,
mm-hmm.
somehow related to the United States intelligence community. And we just assume, oh, well, you know, that's just how it is. That's their cutout to the equation to do the cyber activity. The Russians probably have the same thing. And as the Chinese and the Iranians and the North Koreans, well, maybe not the North Koreans, but the Israelis and most normal countries that we interact with have their, you know, their processes, and their languages, and the way that they talk, and the times of day that they operate. And probably, you know, if I was running the cyber school, I would be telling people, stagger how you attack.
Yeah.
But even that is going to be
an artifact.
To, you know, if you stagger every attack by a set amount, that will be discernible.
Yeah.
And if you stagger every cyber activity that you do by a random amount, that also specifies something, because how are you generating that random interval to wait?
Yeah.
So these are all things that I'm going to say are above my pay grade, are beyond my skills. I don't know how to figure these things out or how to evaluate them.
Yeah.
But the guys who've been doing it for 20 years, they
do.
I'm gonna.
Or they have a better idea.
I'm gonna hope that they do.
Yeah.
I'm gonna believe that they do, because otherwise, it's just I'm speechless. I just can't.
Because otherwise we're
all
a serious problem. We're all lost.
We've got bigger problems than.
I mean, you brought up a good point though. The sheer sort of effort that it would take to do all this suggests that it's got to be a pretty, if not a state-sponsored or nation-state-directed attack, it's got to be a group with considerable resources, considerable manpower, considerable ability. And so just by nature of the type of attacks, it suggests that it's coming from, you know, a state-sponsored APT or nation-state, however you want to describe it. It's just that I think when you start throwing things out like a Russian IP address or a Russian company, you know, that to me seems flimsy. And there have been a lot of folks that have taken issue with the attribution to Russia with some of these claims because of that flimsy nature. Not because I think that anyone is trying to say, oh, Russia's they're the good guys. They're an ally, because I think that ship has sailed, unfortunately. And now we're in a situation where even the sort of the smallest bit of evidence is being seen as justification to attribute a cyber attack. But I will say that the CrowdStrike, I mean, there have been a number of vendors that have looked into this, a number of security firms and companies, and the research that they did and the information they provided regarding the DNC hack earlier this year, the spring, early summer, it's pretty compelling. They identified two groups in particular, the Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear, these groups had already been sort of identified as Russian-based threat actors, likely state-sponsored. And they outline a number of elements, technical in nature, that lead them to believe that, yes, these groups were behind this because of, you know, the techniques that they used to breach the system, the patterns of how they interacted once they were inside. So it wasn't just like, oh, they used this malware that could be downloaded or bought by any hacker that knows a dark web address. They do make a solid case there. At the same time, if, you know, CrowdStrike was able to find out these sort of patterns and tools and things that, you know, these two, you know, Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear were doing, I guess if you really wanted to, if you were that sophisticated a group and you did have the resources and the ability, the considerable resources and ability, and you really wanted to get somebody good, you could sit down and map out how to make a cyber attack look like it was coming from one of these groups and drop enough breadcrumbs pointing in that direction. I'm not saying that's what happened. I mean, I think all things considered, the evidence that's been presented by both the government and companies like CrowdStrike and other experts seems compelling enough. It's just that we got to remind ourselves that, like Michael Heller, senior reporter, he wrote a couple of pieces about cyber attribution and said it's very tricky. And according to the people that work on these things, when it comes to the government, or government hacks rather, it takes a considerable amount of human intelligence to go along with the technical evidence, because the technical evidence in a lot of times is fallible. It can be faked. It can be misleading. And if you look at the statement from DHS and the director of national intelligence, one of the things they say is, you know, such activity is not new to Russia. The Russians, quote, the Russians have used similar tactics and techniques across Europe and Eurasia, for example, to influence public opinion there. I mean, that suggests to me, and we've talked about this with Mike and other folks on our Slack channel discussing the latest news, that this has to, this most likely involves some other intel communities, intel agencies from other countries saying, hey, this happened to us. It, you know, it fits the pattern that you're seeing here. And, you know, maybe human intel on the ground somewhere saying, oh yeah, there's been chatter about this or this operation or this type of hack. So there seems to be that element of it as well. But Peter, I want to ask you, like, let's say this case is closed and it's Russia or it's a Russian sponsored group. What does that really do? Like, well, how much does this cyber attribution mean? And I guess I'll put it in terms, obviously it's important for the government. We want to know who might be potentially fiddling with our election systems. Of course, could be an act of war. But what if you're an enterprise? What if you're an organization? You know, CrowdStrike said in its report, it specifically said, and I know they have government clients, but they have a lot of commercial clients. And they said that these, you know, these APT groups, Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear, have, I almost said Fozzie Bear, have been attacking our clients before. So how important is attribution? If you're an enterprise and you find out something like this has happened to you and you have a firm or several firms who come in, or DHS, and they come in and they say, yes, we think it was this nation state and this particular group. What is that? How important is that?
Well, I mean, that's pretty important. One of the things that comes up a lot, people talk about Tor protecting them.
Sure.
And the thing about Tor is, while they would love for it to protect you against an APT or a nation state, they can't go that far. If you're in the sights of a nation state and they're looking to harm you, you really...
It's probably going to happen, is what you're saying?
It's a lot harder to defend against than if you're defending against anything less than that.
Right.
So, and I'm not talking about cyber in particular. I'm talking about anything. If
sure.
a nation state says, you're a bad guy, you've got a real problem.
Yeah,
or
yeah.
a powerful nation state, let me put it that way.
Yeah.
With a long reach. And there are many like that. So that's on the one hand. But on the other hand, if you're an enterprise and you're being targeted by an APT or a nation state who is looking to get your data, then the first thing you have to do is figure out, why is your data being targeted? And
yeah.
for a lot of companies, it's really obvious. If you're a defense contractor, it's really going to look bad if you find out that the plans for the devices or the armaments or the platforms that
sure.
you're working on show up facing the wrong way
yeah.
with the wrong flag painted on them.
Sure.
Okay. And not only that, you're losing money. It's costing you money, because you want to be able to sell those things to other countries, because our country isn't the only buyer. So those are all pretty key things. You do want to be able to attribute that, and so that you can try to at least defend against it.
Yeah, but, I mean, you can't. That was sort of part of the point was, you know, you can't. Enterprises are not in the position of the government where they can step in and say, oh well, now we're going to drive economic sanctions against your country, or we're gonna hack back. Enterprises can't really do that. So what is cyber attribution get you? And I'll say this, it is interesting, you know, doubling back to the Yahoo breach that we've also talked about and written a lot about, and we'll continue to write and talk a lot about, because that story ain't going anywhere. But they said, I mean, in the first line of their breach notification or public breach disclosure announcement, they said, quote, a recent investigation by Yahoo has confirmed that a copy of certain user information was stolen from the company's network in late 2014 by what it believes is a state-sponsored actor, end quote. And they mentioned that a couple times. In the Yahoo statement, that is you know, that state-sponsored angle, I think it appears at least two other times. Now, that's been called into question. We still don't know what went on with the Yahoo breach, what is sort of credible in this case. But I guess if you're an enterprise and you can say this was a nation state, it kind of, I don't want to say it takes you off the hook, but it certainly looks better than if you were breached because, you know, some Lizard Squad member or some, you know, lower level hacker was able to waltz into your network and steal a bunch of data. And I just worry that that sort of nation state attribution might be misused by companies going forward. And in order to say, look, what were we going to do? It was Russia. It was China. It was whoever. What? We couldn't defend against it. We don't have that capability.
It's a good point.
Thank you.
And it's certainly, it's not a new point, because we've been, you know, we've traded barbs over time about companies that get up and make a statement about their being brought down by a sophisticated cyber attack.
Oh, sophisticated. I love that word. I would trade actually nation state or state sponsored attack for sophisticated attack.
Well, and I see them all as being sort of conflated a little bit. But when somebody when a PR person releases a press release that says that we were shut down by a sophisticated cyber attack that targeted our SQL injection vulnerability, it's like saying we got nuked by somebody throwing an egg at the car.
Yeah.
It's one
still bothers you. I know. It still bothers you. Yeah. To your point about the situation with sophistication and how do you judge that? I mean, obviously, Sony was the victim of what I think generally everybody accepts is it was a nation state attack from North Korea that, you know, really hurt them pretty badly. But no one sort of gave Sony a free pass for getting hacked by that North Korean threat actor group, at least no one that I've seen, because of the nature of the technical details that have come out about how that was done and sort of the complete lack of defenses and security measures in place to prevent that stuff from really wreaking havoc within the company. So I will say that I don't think that attributing it to a nation state attack, a breach to a nation state attack, a nation state group is a get out of jail free card. Obviously we've seen that not be the case, but it will be interesting to see how attribution and the claim of a possible nation state attack, how that is used by enterprises going forward. So something to keep an eye on, you know, as it pertains to the enterprise, the private sector side of this. But I guess we should probably wrap up there and save our energy for the next podcast, which we'll be doing in a few days. I know you're thrilled.
No, I am.
You're a good sport, Peter.
This is a lot of fun for me.
Thank you. It's fun for me too, in a weird kind of way. So, and with that, I'm Rob Wright, editor of Search Security. Thanks again for listening to the latest episode of Risk and Repeat, and we will see you next time.